Okay. First order of business to come out of this office is a citywide gay rights ordinance, just like the one that Anita shot down in Dade County.
I never heard this story, and the first time I read the script, I was like, shocked. It's a story I felt guilty I didn't know, you know? It's an important story to know.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you!
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Courageous campaigns mark World AIDS Day, 100 laws extend new rights to Aussie couples, and Milk makes history again on the big screen. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Torres.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the 2 weeks ending December 6th, 2008. Among the numerous vigils, demonstrations, and other events marking the 20th annual World AIDS Day on December 1st, one of the most heartening for LGBT people must have been the participation by some brave openly gay men in a pre-AIDS Day march in the Haitian city of St. Mark on November 30th. It may be the first time self-identified gay people have participated in a public event in the Caribbean. About a dozen men wore T-shirts declaring, "I am gay and I am living with HIV." They were welcomed by march organizers. One of the country's most prominent AIDS activists said that they suffered double the stigma and double the discrimination. Socially conservative Haiti has one of the highest infection rates in the world. Gay men and lesbians face stigma and entrenched homophobia in the former French colony. The number of people with HIV has risen in every region of the world in the past 2 years, with the fastest increases being seen in East and Central Asia and in Eastern Europe. There were specific reports this week that infection rates among gay men in particular have risen sharply in China, the UK, and Israel.
Men who have sex with men in Africa are 9 times more likely to be HIV positive than their heterosexual counterparts. A coalition of groups, including the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, and representatives of 25 African LGBT and HIV/AIDS organizations, issued a statement this week decrying the lack of access by LGBTI people to education, prevention, and treatment programs on the continent. At a pre-conference event in early December, before the start of the International Conference on AIDS and Sexually Transmitted Infections in Africa, held in Dakar, Senegal, their delegates condemned rampant human rights violations experienced by sexual minorities and vowed to lobby international donors, national HIV agencies, and African governments to act on their concerns. About 2 in 3 African countries outlaw consensual adult homosexual acts. Only 7 have included men who have sex with men in their national plans for HIV/AIDS prevention, and among those countries, only South Africa includes lesbians as part of its response to the pandemic. According to Fikile Vilakazi, director of the Coalition of African Lesbians, the gendered nature of the limited interventions aggravates the situation even further.
Notoriously homophobic Moscow Mayor Yuri Luzhkov, speaking at an AIDS conference in the Russian capital this week, said that he would continue to ban LGBT pride events in his city to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS. "We have banned and will continue to forbid this propaganda by sexual minorities," he said, "as it could turn out to be one of the factors in the spread of HIV infections." The 72-year-old Luzhkov, who's called pride events satanic, has fought against pro-LGBT public events in Moscow for the past several years.
But an unprecedented declaration against discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity will be presented to the United Nations General Assembly later this month. The initiative follows a campaign by the Coordinating Committee of the International Day Against Homophobia, or IDAHO, which received support from the French government. All 27 countries of the European Union have signed the declaration, and efforts are ongoing to secure more signatories. Canada, New Zealand, Israel, Japan, Mexico, and about a half dozen South American countries have also signed on, as have Iceland and several European countries that are not part of the EU. Most notably absent as signatories are Australia and the United States. the Vatican this week announced its strong opposition to the anti-discrimination effort. While it doesn't have a vote in the UN, a Vatican spokesman noted that fewer than 50 of about 200 member states have endorsed the proposal and warned that those that haven't will be pilloried and made an object of pressure. Organizers say they hope to convince the General Assembly to pass a resolution calling for the decriminalization of homosexuality worldwide.
Meanwhile, Australia's Senate and House of Representatives passed legislation in late November that changes some 100 laws to give gay and lesbian couples equal rights. The changes, introduced by the Labor government of Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, extend spousal rights to same-gender de facto couples in areas such as health care, taxation, pensions, parenting, public benefits, workplace benefits, workers' compensation, veterans' affairs, elder care, and educational assistance. Australian federal law, however, defines marriage as exclusively heterosexual. LGBT activist groups generally cheered the new legislation, but some have criticized the lack of a grandfather clause, retroactivity, in the legislation. They say that elderly, long-term, same-gender couples who register under the new laws may lose pension income and other benefits and could be prosecuted for fraud.
Elsewhere, Burundi's parliament in late November overwhelmingly voted to specifically outlaw gay sex as part of a package of more than 600 changes to the Central African nation's penal code. Progressives cheered the abolition of the death penalty in that package, but have condemned the criminalization of gay sex. According to Amnesty International, male-male sex was previously banned and punished in Burundi under laws governing immoral acts. The new measure specifically punishes consensual adult gay sex in the impoverished country, with a large fine and a jail term of between 3 months and 2 years. The president of the European Parliament's Intergroup on Gay and Lesbian Rights, Michael Cashman, discussed the matter with the European Commissioner for Development and Humanitarian Aid, Lewis Michael. Cashman told reporters that the commissioner was shocked to learn of this law and said he will travel to Burundi and discuss his concerns with the government. Executive Director Paula Edelbrick of the U.S.-based International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, IGLHRC, said that these laws are meant to silence and terrorize our community.
Conventional queer wisdom holds that one of the most welcoming cities in the world for LGBT people is Amsterdam. But the University of Amsterdam presented a study last week revealing a drastic increase in homophobic acts in the Dutch capital. Police received more than 150 reports of anti-gay violence there in the first half of 2008. That number is probably much higher because many incidents go unreported. It was the first time police made an effort to specifically keep track of anti-gay hate, which represented 10% of all reported bias-based incidents. Some 28% of homophobic attacks were physical assaults, with the remainder involving verbal abuse, threats, intimidation, or vandalism. A high percentage of the incidents took place in gay bar districts and other places where gay men congregate. Nearly all the victims were male. Immigrants were previously thought to be the major perpetrators of anti-gay incidents, but the study concluded that the attackers are usually young native-born Dutchmen between 17 and 25 years old, with little education, who come from dysfunctional families, feel insecure about their masculinity, and are highly impressionable. City officials plan a new anti-homophobia campaign and to encourage greater police visibility in predominantly gay areas. Victims of homophobic violence are also being urged to come forward to increase public awareness of the problem.
But in the U.S., a Florida circuit court in Miami has struck down a state law that barred lesbians and gay men from adopting. The court granted adoptions to a gay man represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, who with his partner has been raising two foster children, 4 and 8-year-old brothers, since 2004. Martin Gill, a North Miami resident, told reporters that he and his partner are extremely relieved that the court has recognized that it is wrong to deny our boys the legal protections and security that only come with adoption. The court ruled that the ban violated the equal protection guarantees of the state constitution because it irrationally singled out gay and lesbian people and their children for different treatment and denied children the right to permanency as mandated by federal and state law. The Florida measure barring gays and lesbians from adopting passed in 1977 as part of a homophobic crusade led by former Miss America runner-up Anita Bryant. Attempts since then to repeal the law in the state legislature have failed. The Florida Attorney General's Office has said it will appeal the ruling.
And finally, several new activities are being planned by Join the Impact, the grassroots group that coordinated the huge November 15th protests against California's Proposition 8 and other bans on marriage equality. Those protests, driven mostly by online organizing, took place in some 300 cities in all 50 U.S. states. December 10th has been dubbed a Day Without a Gay. Among other things, Join the Impact urges all LGBT people not to spend any money on that day. Candlelight vigils around the country in malls or other shopping areas are planned for December 20th. Participants are urged to wear shirts that say second-class citizen. Join the Impact is calling for marches on the 50 state capitals on January 10th as a national protest against DOMA, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. The group says it wants to remind President-elect Barack Obama that he's promised to push for repeal of that law. DOMA bans federal recognition of same-gender couples, whether they're in state-sanctioned civil unions or domestic partnerships, or even those who've married in states where it's legal. And Join the Impact is calling for nationwide peaceful civil disobedience sit-ins on February 12th at marriage license bureaus. If you are denied a license, don't leave, the group says. Let's show this country just how many U.S. citizens are denied equal protections under the law. Change will not come if we sit back and do nothing, they say. Change comes through visibility, conversation, demonstration, and action. For updates and more information, log on to jointheimpact.com.
That's News Wrap for the 2 weeks ending December 6th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Torres.
It's that time of the year again when many of you in the U.S. consider ways to maximize your annual charitable tax deductions. Unlike many other worthwhile causes, we can't survive without your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to get some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives and further reduce your U.S. tax liability. No matter where you are in the world, we can't go on without you. Log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. From the This Way Out family to you and yours, thank you and happy holidays.
An electrifying performance by an Oscar-winning actor and a powerful collaboration of two of Hollywood's standout gay filmmakers tells the story of a camera store owner who became the first openly gay elected official in the United States. Over 30 years ago, I personally sat in the back of that camera store and interviewed the new San Francisco supervisor. Now, a much-anticipated movie is taking audiences back to that pivotal time and place in movement history. This Way Out, Steve Pride is the interviewer today, sitting with the director, the writer, and some of the cast members of Milk.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you!
A movie about Harvey Milk has been in development at Warner Brothers since 1992. Some of Hollywood's best screenwriters have churned out over 20 scripts, and over the years, Daniel Day-Lewis, Kevin Kline, Richard Gere, Kevin Spacey, James Woods, Robin Williams, and even Steve Carell were all prospective Harvey Milks. So when I heard that Gus Van Sant was in San Francisco filming Milk with Sean Penn in the title role, I was surprised it wasn't connected to the Warner Brothers project.
By the time Lance brought the script over, which is a year and three quarters ago, almost 2 years ago, the Warner Brothers project had been in a state of somewhat dormancy because it had been 16 or so years, and it had been in and out of different incarnations, and there was a new incarnation with Bryan Singer, but he was very busy, and it was just one of those projects, like in development type of projects, that I think it only affected us in the sense of, like, you know, if we start going on it, does that make the other projects start going too? Which I think existed for us. We never really knew what was going on. We were sort of in the dark. It was very spy versus spy.
It's been 5 years since I last spoke with outwriter Dustin Lance Black, but I suppose I don't have to ask what he's been up to in the meantime.
I started actually diving into the research and doing the work on the movie about 4 years ago, so that'd be about 2004. I think that's right around the time that I had a friend introduce me to Cleve Jones. And I've been wanting to tell the story for a long time, probably in some form or another, do something with the story or the message of the story since I heard it when I was like a teenage kid. Definitely after I came out, it became something I was focused on again. You know, it would just continually come up. I finally saw the documentary. That was really inspirational. And then in 2004, this buddy of mine said he wanted to do a rock opera about Cleve Jones, and I just had no idea that Cleve was even still alive. You know, so many of the leaders of that community, you know, didn't make it through the AIDS crisis in the 80s, especially those that lived in San Francisco, but Cleve did. And it didn't take more than a couple hours of hanging out with Cleve to know that there was a connection there, to hear like the vibrancy of the stories, to know that there was more to it than I'd ever heard. There's more to Harvey than I had read or seen. And thankfully, the guy had faith in me, you know, because there was no studio, there was no money. There was my charge card, and we would head up to San Francisco. And usually, like an hour out of San Francisco, he'd call Beck's Motor Lodge and say, "Hey, we need a place to crash. You got a couple rooms?" And we would we'd do an interview at a time. And then eventually, I had met the folks, and I would just start going up on my own a little bit and doing those interviews and digging and trying to find people who had either worked with him, or like Art Agnos, who had ran against him, people who he had dated or rubbed, you know, shoulders with in sort of a more personal way or a family way. And so, yeah, it's years.
And what was his biggest surprise about Harvey Milk?
The people I was interviewing were cautious at first. So you were getting little pieces of information. You were slowly kind of getting access to Harvey. So there weren't like any huge aha moments because you were slowly adjusting to getting to know the man. Looking back, it's like, I don't think when I first heard his story that I would have ever assumed he was so bad at so much in his life. He had failed as a businessman. He couldn't figure out a job that he really cared about. He went from one occupation to the next. He, you know, he was a passionate boyfriend and very romantic, but so closeted that I think he, you know, in a way tortured these younger guys that he dated who were kind of eager to come out and be more open. And you know, it's basically just how flawed he was as a person. And I, you know, that's what you sort of don't know when you see some of the other stuff that's out there about him. And you kind of only get to find out if you really get to work and find things out firsthand.
Gus Van Sant filmed on location in San Francisco in the actual storefront that had been Harvey Milk's camera store in the 1970s.
When we first got to San Francisco, the city really hadn't had that many films come there because it's really hard to sort of find places to put the vehicles and the hills. It's just really a pain, and I guess that's one of the main reasons, but the locations were really quite easy compared to stuff like that. The shop, it's a gift shop called Given, and they had a mural of Harvey inside the shop. So they were very into the legacy of the store, and they were just willing to let us close their shop down, which meant, you know, not being able to sell like their things, and let us move our set in there for, I think it was, 3 weeks. And that was relatively easy. The business association on the Castro was like very supportive. Most of the people on the street were really supportive of the project. And then the rest of the city was quite easy, yeah.
Emil Hirsch plays Cleve Jones.
First and foremost thing for me was just talking to Cleve Jones. And he was extraordinarily helpful. So what we did was, you know, we would just get together, we'd go eat, we'd go drive around San Francisco, he'd show me different locations and certain, you know, the symbols of where he was, you know, the places he used to hang out, you know. And it was really fascinating hearing his stories because he has so many. And you hear some of these tales of, you know, mischief and mayhem that he kind of went through when he was younger. And you kind of get transported to that time and place. You know, he'll say, you see down that street, you know, I was leading a crowd of 10,000 screaming drag queens at midnight 30 years ago. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Playing a historical figure while they look on had its own challenges.
I mean, there was definitely an elevated pressure in a certain sense. But at the same time, I always liked to do little things that would kind of drive him crazy. And, you know, I'd just be goofy or I'd do a weird little movement. And I knew that it would bother him. he understood that, you know, he was like, listen, you know, you're doing an interpretation. You're not me. You know, it's your decision to do a lot of different things. And I went, cool. And I held him to it.
In the 1980s, Cleve Jones co-founded the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and conceived the AIDS Memorial Quilt. I ask Emil if knowing what Cleve would later accomplish impacted his portrayal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted to play him to where, you know, you could see potential in him, but in the beginning, you don't necessarily have to see some saint. And, you know, Cleve says, he's like, listen, I'm not a saint, you know. Cleve's a, in many ways, you know, a regular guy, a very intelligent, funny, caring guy. But, you know, I didn't want to portray Cleve as a saint. If anything, I wanted to portray him as a rebel or a kind of a renegade, kind of.
In this scene from Milk, Harvey and his team have just moved in to his new office at City Hall.
Okay, first order of business to come out of this office is a citywide gay rights ordinance, just like the one that Anita shot down in Dade County. What do you think, Lotus Blossom?
I think it's good. It's not great.
Okay, so make it brilliant. We want Anita's attention here in San Francisco. I wanted to bring her fight to us. We need a unanimous vote. We need headlines.
Dan White is not going to vote for this.
Dan White will be fine. Dan White is just uneducated. We'll teach him.
Hey, Harv, committee meets at 9:30. Hey, you guys. Say, did you get the invitation to my son's christening? I invited a few of the other soups, too.
Oh, well, I'll be there.
Great. Thanks.
Did he hear you?
What the f- are you going?
I would let him christen me if it means he's going to vote for the gay rights ordinance. We need allies.
I think he can
hear
me.
We need everyone.
Jesus.
I don't think he heard you.
Is it just me, or is he cute?
There's an old saying that behind every successful man, there's a woman. In Harvey's case, it was a man named Scott Smith. In Milk, he's portrayed by the extraordinary actor James Franco.
It was pretty amazing just being able to shoot there what had been the center of the gay movement in the entire world. That was it. And to be doing it there, where it all happened, was very unique for me.
And Franco was not just awed by the memory of those brave activists.
Those people were like advisors on the movie, so they were there every day, like Cleve Jones and Danny Nicoletta and Frank Robinson. And some of them, you know, they're there. I think they're all in the movie. They play little cameos, not themselves, but other roles. And so they were there every day. And it was a very unique working on that set, especially in the camera shop on Castor Street. And I remember when Frank Robinson, who was Harvey Milk's speechwriter, he also wrote the novel of The Towering Inferno, when he walked onto the set and, you know, I was sitting behind the desk and, you know, the other actors were there. And he, like, looked at me and you could just see in his eyes, it was almost like he was being transported back. And from that moment on, he just called everybody by their character names because those had been his friends. And it's not like he was a, you know, method actor or anything like that. It was just that he'd been, in a way, kind of transported back. And it was just almost like easier just to call everybody by their character names.
Diego Luna plays Harvey's last lover, Jack Lira.
I knew more about Castro area. I knew more about the movement in San Francisco, but I didn't know any of the specifics, you know. And I was there at a film festival showing my documentary, and I showed it at the Castro Theater. And I remember hearing the name, but as part of a bigger thing, you know. I never heard this story, and the first time I read the script, I was like, shocked. It's a story I felt guilty I didn't know, you know. It's an important story to know. Basically, it's important to know there was a guy that changed the life of many in those years, you know. There's a feeling that you're doing an important story because it matters to people, you know, and we could feel that around the Castro area, you know, how this man changed the life of many and how this man made that place such a free place, a happy place to be in.
We all have our time machines. Some take us back, they're called memories. Some take us forward, they're called dreams. The film Milk offers a little of both. And according to Gus Van Sant, during filming, those lines began to blur.
There was a take where we were using sort of most of the room, but the camera was pointed in one direction, and there were three or four actors in the scene, and it's at night. I think it might have been the night where Anne Cronenberg, like, gets the endorsement. And there were some people sitting in the sofa, which was outside. And during one of the takes, just somebody walked in from outside and sat down in the sofa during the shot. And after the shot was over and we yelled cut, he got up and walked out. And so the actors were like, did you see that guy? And I said, who was it? I didn't see anybody. And they said, no, somebody walked in and sat down and walked out. And I was asking him, like, what he looked like. And they kept describing Harvey. And I thought, well, maybe that was like the ghost of Harvey just sort of walking in for a brief second.
And if it had been Harvey in the camera store, what would Dustin Lance Black have said to him?
Oh, I mean, to Harvey, you know, I would say thank you to Harvey. Harvey, I mean, I know it sounds corny, but when I first heard his story and I was a teenager, I was really lucky that we'd been transferred out of an army base in San Antonio, Texas, and transferred up to the Bay Area. And my mom had remarried, so we were out of the Mormon church. And I was sort of able to get out of this really conservative world that I had grown up in, and super fortunate to have heard the story of Harvey Milk at a theater that I was working at. And I was very closeted. I was sort of a dark kid, you know. I was, it's not easy keeping that secret, especially in a world where, you know, in the Mormon church, it is damnation. You are taught from an early age in a conservative environment that you're less than. And to hear about even the notion of an out gay man, like, that was new. I didn't know what that was. I thought if you're gay, it's shameful, you hide it and you try to beat it down. And I didn't know that you could just sort of be out, much less be openly gay and elected to office and celebrated by people and remembered. I mean, this is, you know, a decade or more after he was assassinated that I was hearing his story. And I don't doubt that it kept me alive long enough to finally find a place where I was strong enough and comfortable enough to come out of the closet.
Harvey Milk was an ordinary man. He was not a saint. He was not a genius. His personal life was often in disarray. He died penniless. And yet, by his example and by his actions, he most certainly changed the world. We've been talking to Gus Van Sant, Dustin Lance Black, Emil Hirsch, Diego Luna, and James Franco about their new film, Milk. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, John Torres, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Sherry Lunn, and Steve Pride contributed program material, Sylvester performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to postal mail CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KALW San Francisco, California, CHMA Sackville, New Brunswick, WRVU Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.